So I want to share a little bit. So about the third and fourth noble truths. Last time we talked about the first two, and some of you, you know, this may be something new for you. So I'm going to give a tiny little review about the overview and then talk about the third and fourth. And you could, and as some of you know, this is the core teaching that the Buddha gave, and the first teaching the Buddha gave. And it's, I mean, I'm going to say that in a minute, but I just had to say at the beginning, it's the thing to understand about the Dharma. And you could say of the Four Noble Truths that the first two state the problem and the second two state the solution. So therefore, in a way, what we're sharing tonight should be the funnest part. So I'm glad we can be together to explore this. And how many, I sort of have a sense of how many were not here last time. So let me just set up a little bit about where we're going. And as I said, this is the very first teachings that the Buddha shared with the five ascetics who had been his friends for years of practice, 6 years of practice prior to awakening. And he shared this in Sarnath, which is just outside of Varanasi and about 150 miles from where he awakened in Bodh Gaya. So you can imagine sitting under a tree, probably, because it's a good thing to do in India, and in the grass, talking to these five ascetics. And they seem really simple in a way, but if we really realize what these four are, we'd be awakened. So this is, you know, the whole path is right here. I mean, you can say the whole path is in lots of places. It's the holographic nature of it, but the whole path is also right here. So the first truth is most simply that an unawakened life doesn't work out so well. It's unsatisfactory just because we're buffeted around by outside factors over which we have no control. We're kind of at the mercy of our universe inside and outside. Have we ever been convinced that a new car or a trip to Hawaii or a new relationship would bring us happiness? You know? And then we realize there's conditions in that. And it just didn't work like we'd planned. It's just the nature of it. We can't depend on outer stuff to bring us continuous just happiness. And the second truth is, in a sense, the cause of the problem. Because unawakened life doesn't ultimately satisfy because we depend on things, we cling to things that are temporary and undependable. And in fact, everything, all conditioned phenomena are by their very nature temporary and undependable because they're temporary. We cling to our bodies, we cling to our sense experiences, our accomplishments, our identity, and we're ultimately disappointed. Just because it's so inherently conditional. We just don't have any control over the conditions. The third noble truth is a solution. And you'd think this would be the most popular subject in Buddhism, but oddly it doesn't get too much attention, partly because it's kind of nebulous what awakening is, what nibbana is. It's hard to understand and point toward, but it's helpful. So a few words about the third noble truth. In this first sermon, the Buddha described it this way. He said, "This, bhikkhus, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it." So, you know, it sort of sounds like renunciation, except renunciation gets a bad rap in the West because of our Judeo-Christian heritage, maybe, of sort of renouncing stuff that we want, and then we're kind of bummed out and shortchanged. But this is really just relinquishing that which binds us, and then we have freedom. Let's explore three metaphors and maybe clarify what the Buddha meant by cessation of suffering by nibbana. And it's interesting that it can be looked at as a negative, kind of one of these paradoxes. It's a negative, freedom from suffering, but also a positive, this vast awakening or freedom. It's both things at once. And the awakening at the core of this third noble truth may seem like impossibly far away in our complicated 21st century lives. But it isn't. You know, and everyone here it's a beautiful thing. That's why it's so great to share. Everyone spoke about little facets of nibbana that they experienced over these last few weeks. Just little hints and tastes that are totally real. Buddhadasa, he's a Thai monk who was one of the great Buddhist masters of the 20th century. He was especially emphatic and encouraging about these hints of awakening. There's a great book, Heartwood of the Bodhi Tree. And towards the end, in a discussion about recognizing emptiness, he says, "You must now go and observe yourself until you can grasp that, in fact, you yourself are frequently void. There are many times when you are unconfused, and there is a great deal of mindfulness and wisdom. However, people stupidly skip over such moments, overlook the spontaneous nibbana, and so are unaware of its presence. Even if it's only a very small nibbana, merely a taste, it's exactly the same thing as true and lasting nibbana." So, you know, I think that's part of the beauty of what we were hearing tonight, is people were really recognizing and treasuring those little moments of liberation, of being able to be open-handed with what their diagnosis was going to be, of being able to find some steadiness about whether or not they got the job and see the dance, you know, in the mind and heart, or, you know, with the incredibly difficult relative, being able to hold that with some grace. That's a little moment of nibbana. It's amazing. So here are three metaphors for the third noble truth that come at it in different ways. Buddha uses metaphors all the time. Metaphors of fire and the ending of fire and cooling as the opposite of fire appear repeatedly throughout the suttas, what the Buddha said. In fact, the word nibbana in ancient India was used to refer to rice which had become cool enough to eat. Buddhadasa writes, "People nowadays will smile at this, but the word commonly used to describe anything which had once been hot but had since cooled down was nibbana. When boiled rice is nibbana, it can be comfortably eaten, while it can't be if it's still too hot. Thus, the cook might call to those waiting outside, 'Come and eat. The rice is nibbana.'" And think about in our own mindfulness practice, you know, how bringing mindfulness to a heated arising. Think about how in our mindfulness practice, bringing mindfulness to a heated arising, maybe a thinking or emotion, it cools it. That's what people are talking about today. We feel this longing and we can identify it as burning, burning, or pain, pain. But the more we're mindfulness, we cultivate mindfulness, the more the experience cools because we're not identified with it. We're not sucked into it. We can just rest with this fire and it doesn't burn us. So this cooling aspect, and that's the taste of nibbana. Every small step of cooling is worth cultivating, and they accumulate over years of practice. Metaphors of the unconditioned, as the second one, are also repeated constantly. And this refers to another sort of approach or understanding of nibbana. At the very root of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, is the fact that everything is conditioned. This means that everything arises from a prior condition, a prior cause, and in turn causes something else. And when we become entwined with things through desire or aversion, we by definition become entwined in this conditioning, this stream of causality. And that's why it's impossible to be free if we allow ourselves to be tangled. I had this funny experience yesterday. I was riding my bike through Kirkland up at the overpass near 405. And this guy drives by in this brand new black Ferrari. It was a beautiful car. No question, it was a beautiful car. But, you know, they have this thing, better to drive a slow car fast than a fast car slow. And someone turned a corner ahead of him and got a little bit, and he just nailed it. You know, you hear this 12 cylinders just shrieking, and he went about 25 feet before he had hit the brakes. And I could feel the frustration, you know, and it was just like, wow, this having a Ferrari thing is really working out well for you, dude. So it's, you know, it's like that. Like, he's entwined. He was so entwined in his idea of Ferrari and what he wanted and the zoom that he wanted to happen. And I mean, it was just ridiculous to do what he just did. So we can free from being tangled, and we can start to see, you know, when you think of it that way, you can see the interconnections of things and the streams of causality and where we are in them and the wheels we've set rolling. And the more we can see that, the freer we can become from it. Because one of the ways mindfulness works is we become aware of the dependent arising of things, that nothing happens in a vacuum. It has a prior cause. There is a sequence of cause and effect. That's what karma is. And we can see the condition behind things and kind of just track back in history. Not that we're trying to psychoanalyze ourselves. It just kind of clarifies. And the more this becomes clear, the less likely we adhere to it. There's a Pali word, sankharas, which refers to conditioned phenomena. And Bhikkhu Bodhi writes, through the practice of the Buddha's path, the practitioner arrives at the true knowledge of conditioned phenomena, which disables the generation of active sankharas, putting an end to the constructing of conditioned reality and opening up the door to the deathless, the unconditioned, which is nibbana, final liberation from impermanence and suffering. And then lastly, you know, most directly is the end of craving and clinging as a doorway to nibbana. And remember the Buddha named craving or clinging as a second noble truth, the cause of dukkha, the cause of suffering. So conversely, we can find freedom just by seeing through craving, by dropping it. And when we feel it, to be aware of it and let it blow through. So it's not like we're forcing ourselves into something by any kind of guilt or anything like that, but just see it clearly and it just doesn't grab us. And we can see how interlinked this clinging in that way is with conditioned existence. Because when we're clinging, we're turning outward to conditioned existence in a search for happiness. But we know once we start to realize it's doomed, just because it's so independable, then we can let it go. And we also cling to our sense of self as a condition, you know, trying to find satisfaction there. But all that stuff we identify with, that guy's Ferrari's going to break down, it's going to get old. And, you know, best vacation we were ever at with ourselves or someone we loved got rained on sooner or later, or it ended, or the sunset ended, or something happened. So just to be able to roll with that, and we can penetrate this clinging and see the complexity of our clinging and start to penetrate the selfing, which is doing the clinging. And as those come apart, the whole thing isn't as concrete, and our whole sort of drama about what we get and what we don't starts to come apart. And then we're at ease no matter what. We're at ease no matter what. What a joy. So we're moving in the direction of nibbana. And then the fourth noble truth is where the Buddha's prescription for awakening kind of lands in our lives, where he tells us what to do, how to accomplish this. And it's in turn, the fourth noble truth is made up of the Noble Eightfold Path, which are particular actions we can cultivate to awaken. So, you know, we don't have much time, and I don't want to get bogged down in details, but I'm going to kind of toss out a few entry points or ways to approach it that may be helpful. I want this to be helpful. You can go on the line and search for it in Wikipedia and read about it in detail. But here's the eight, just to take it in. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. And you can see there's a way in which these move towards more deeper and more subtle aspects, ending up with mindfulness and concentration. even though, interestingly, it starts with view, supported in the middle by ethical and practical considerations. So here's a few perspectives that might be useful to you in case you go read about this in Wikipedia. By the way, Bhikkhu Bodhi has a nice little book about the Eightfold Path too. So one thing that's worth taking in this classical sequencing, the series starts with right view, a sense of where we're going, of cause and effect. So even before we move forward, and this speaks to the importance of a sense of direction, knowing where we're going on the path before we try to go there. And that's that kind of how practice works. We practice and we learn and they inform each other. So it starts with view. And it's always kind of a balance because, you know, if we overconceptualize that, we might box ourselves in, but it helps us know where we're going. It's like the finger pointing at the moon. We need view to know where we're going, and we need intention to have a sense of how we're going to exercise will to get there. We decide to do something. We decide to move ourselves ahead. So right view gives us a sense of the journey ahead, and right intention gives us a sense of activating our energy towards that. A second key perspective has to do with the quality of our actions and how we live and the ethical choices we make and how essential these are. And this is really important because, you know, there's this sort of sad history of charismatic spiritual teachers kind of going off the rails in this area, getting too captivated by their power or taking advantage of persons who are students, all kinds of stuff. So it's right there in the Eightfold Path that ethical choices are crucial because it's the only way we can keep our energy clear. And when people mess up ethically, they're doing it for selfing. They're doing it to get some experience, basically. So they just kind of got off the rails. They blew it. And the three noble truths in this area are right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And it's really worth thinking about how relevant they totally are 2,500 years from when the Buddha offered them. He's suggesting that there's three areas of choices and actions that are essential to calm the inner storms in our minds and hearts so the practice will work. And right action just refers to bedrock ethical choices, you know, refraining from killing, from stealing, from lying, from sexual misconduct, from abusive intoxicants, the five precepts. Just that basic ethical stuff. Got to do that. Got to do that to make the path work. Because otherwise, we're putting ourselves ahead of other people. If you kind of drill down into those, it's always about me first. And right there, you know, if we're trying to see through selfing to do me first, we just blew it. It's like the wrong, opposite direction. And, you know, they were crucial 2,500 years ago. And now, with this sort of high-tech empowerment, I mean, this vast industry that is created to kind of rewards people for financial success, and people are ridiculously financially successful in ways one could not have imagined 2,500 years ago. It encourages people. It's like, oh, you know, I'm not saying anyone's bad or good, but Jeff Bezos can have this giant yacht and whatever. And it sort of seems like ethical stuff is beside the point, but it's not. So it's really important to cultivate that here in 2021, 22. I get 21st century and 2022 confused. I apologize. And the key is that it's not harming others, not putting ourselves before others. And you can see how this connects up with loving kindness and compassion, putting others before ourselves. Then that flips it the other way when we do it in a loving way. And that brings freedom. People who do that are free. You ever notice that? People who are really generous, they're free. They're not sticky. It's so beautiful. And that's the cooling of the bana. Brings it right there. And right speech is so powerful, you know, in this world of digital media where stuff flashes around in a globe in a nanosecond and causes all kinds of problems. So maybe in the Buddha it meant what one person said, but now it's amplified. So it's, you can see the power of speech, power of speech. And it's abstaining from lying, from divisive speech, from abusive speech, and from idle chatter. So when you get down in the weeds a little bit, I always think idle chatter is really interesting, you know, because you look at how much time people spend talking to each other about kind of nothing. My wife and I are just, we joke all the time that we just become like ridiculously useless about going to parties. Not that anyone invites us, because it's just like, it just doesn't work, but I don't want to do it, you know? It's just, time is so precious. Don't want to do it. Want to connect, but not just idle chatter about stuff. And then right livelihood, that's so amazing here in this time, you know, just, it strikes me that the Buddha even had that on the list as one of the eight. Because back then, there weren't many choices. I mean, you were a farmer, few other things, you know, make wheels for carts and plows, I don't know what. There wasn't much. Now, it's hugely important. And the short list of what people should avoid is no trading in weapons, no trading in living beings or meat or liquor or poisons. And that's like totally relevant now. It totally works. I mean, that's a great list. And it's tricky. Really have to pay attention. You know, I know people in aerospace, I used to cover aerospace as a journalist, and I knew people, you know, I knew a handful of people in Boeing who were Dharma practitioners, and they stayed away from the defense side for that reason. They didn't want to be creating weapons. And yeah, so it's important. And then the third aspect just to touch on is the way these eight end, by emphasizing the importance of our meditation, our contemplative practice. The very thing we were doing, endeavoring to do, training ourselves to do, practicing doing, however it seemed to you for 40 minutes, is in fact what the Buddha specifically said is what we got to do to practice. And you can kind of see why. You see how miraculously amazing mindfulness is, how it unhooks us from all kind of sticky places, and therefore moves us toward awakening. And right effort is needed to get there, as you were saying. Yeah, as Paul was saying, and everyone laughed, because they know that, right? It doesn't just happen. We gotta lift a little energy, but it totally pays off. But you gotta lift a little energy. And the next is right mindfulness, the very thing we're just talking about. And it's kind of the punchline of the entire list of eight, where it's all been leading, because all these things support mindfulness. And it just shows you how this simple paying attention, or one woman said in the beginning, I can't remember the words she used, but just this broad awareness, open awareness. It's a different way of looking at the same thing, but if you're really openly aware, then you're being aware of everything that arises and passes, which is mindfulness. So essentially the same thing, just how central that is to awakening, this ultimate goal, the simple thing we do. So we're not just, you know, and obviously mindfulness is used in other ways, and they have a program at Google to help themselves be more productive, praise be, and helps with, you know, pain reduction and all kind of good stuff like that. And it also, in particular, brings us toward awakening. So, yeah, what do they call it? G-pause. That's what they call it at Boeing. At Google, I read this off on their website, it said, or down in their bowels of their whatever, some Google document anyway, said, quote, it's a tool that, when used wisely, can boost your experience at work, your relationships with others, and even your overall well-being. Well, that's kind of a little bit of a overall well-being. That's, well, sort of. Okay, good. You know? It's like a little hint of what it really can do. But that's good. That's good. It's all good. And it's funny how, I'm not really in that world, but I know people who are the MBSR world, and there's some people who have a predilection and they start really going deep and they start really having insight in ways that it wasn't exactly designed to do, but because of their own karmic momentum, things really start opening up. It's pretty interesting. They kind of get ahead of the curve. and are seeing the three characteristics, and then they shift into a deeper approach to Dharma. So it's all good. So you see how these come together. You know, we can't practice without right view. We can't practice without these action and speech and livelihood being beneficial. And then once we cross into that bridge, we open into mindfulness practice, and clinging is cut through, and attachment is severed, and the heat is quenched. And we see that everything's impermanent. If everything's dependent on something else, then there's no inherent self there. But you know, as we start to see that everything is impermanent and everything's caused by something else, then we can't find an inherent self. We see that in ourselves. It really helps us not be, you know, drama kings or drama queens, whatever we're doing. Because it all comes from somewhere. And then where is to get stuck? Where is to identify? It just breaks through from this mindfulness. The Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, when one has understood the impermanence of form, its change, fading away, and cessation, when one sees it as it really is, with correct wisdom thus, in the past and also now, all form is impermanent, suffering, and subject to change, then sorrow, lamentation, pain, displeasure, and despair are abandoned. With their abandonment, one does not become agitated. Being unagitated, one dwells happily. A bhikkhu who dwells happily is said to be quenched in that respect." Isn't that beautiful? It pulls together all these threads. And just the last thing to look at is right concentration. You know, it really has a role to be able to cultivate steadiness. That's part of the magic that makes mindfulness work. So how we balance that, a little bit different for every person. Some people have more of a predilection towards concentration and can do that first, and mindfulness arises later, or vice versa. But to keep that in mind, that as much as we can cultivate steadiness while we're being mindful, then it helps move the whole project along. And then, being unagitated, one dwells happily. A bhikkhu who dwells happily is said to be quenched in that respect. So I think I will stop here, because it's good to stop at the Buddha's words. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you.